Good morning. We are in the season of the risen Christ. Christ's disciples have been through so much. They witnessed the public execution of their beloved friend. They have wept with grief and shaken with fear in the uncertainty of what was to come. And then they have been met with both relief and disbelief at his return. Still trembling from the roller coaster of events and emotion, Peter and the apostles begin to travel beyond Jerusalem to bear witness to what they have seen and to, in the words of our collect, steadfastly follow Jesus' steps. I can picture Peter walking these new roads out toward the urban centers of the Mediterranean, perhaps still raw from all that he has experienced, or perhaps filled with zeal from the elation of a risen Christ. Whatever his mood in the moment, I imagine he let his mind wander as he walked, flashing back to a time before everything unfolded. As his sandals kicked up the dirt beneath him, Peter looked down at his dust-filled feet and thought of that last night when Jesus washed them, when he was seated on the floor around that crowded table for their last meal together. Judas had just left the room to go tip that first domino, triggering a series of unfathomable scenes that were still too painful for Peter to fully recount. But Peter let Jesus' words roll around in his mind as he walked that road to Joppa. "I leave you a new commandment," Jesus said to them, "that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also should love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." Was it obvious to Peter on that road to Joppa what that love was to look like? If it was unclear to him then, by the time he arrived in the city, his prayers gave him a most unexpected vision of one piece of that love. He sees four-footed animals and beasts of prey, and hears the Lord telling him to eat the beasts. "It can't be," he must have thought to himself, "to put aside the kosher laws, to break from his own religious rules, could not possibly lead to any good kind of act of love. This could only be a detour from steadfastly following Jesus' steps." And so Peter, being Peter, pleads with Jesus, "Surely this isn't to be so. To enter the home of a cultural stranger for love's sake was to break from his own comforts and his own norms and to share a meal with those who had been so disdainfully marked as unclean." But in the vision, Jesus insists that those cultural distinctions from before his death and resurrection are no more. Where religious rules divide clean from unclean, abiders from heathen, us from them, in from out, love busts the norms, and Peter's countercultural sacrifice is an act of love. What once was no longer, because love descended in its place. But when Peter returns to Jerusalem, he has to address the harsh criticism of his Jewish friends as to why he would share a meal with uncircumcised and unclean men. Their mandate takes them beyond their Jewish community and insists on radically breaking cultural norms and barriers to go proclaim the good news to the Gentiles. Peter explains that the new commandment requires a new paradigm. And the complainers were silenced, but for their praise that this good news was not just for them, but for all. It's nothing short of remarkable to acknowledge the movement that the disciples unleashed, despite how personally uncomfortable this commitment must have been for them. As a privileged American living in such proximity to power and affluence, I feel a bit like Peter, stuck in my cultural norms as I try to follow Jesus' example of love. It makes me personally uncomfortable and I'm not entirely sure that I would have made the cut to be a disciple. The apostles were illiterate peasants who held no cultural or economic power of the day. They followed a man whose love was a consistent act of sacrifice, emptying himself in utter vulnerability. Sacrifice, emptying, and vulnerability are not what makes you successful in Western culture, in America, and definitely not in Silicon Valley. Here, we value achievement, innovations in convenience, material wealth. Many of my days are bound by the cultural norms of building economic security in excess, securing a frictionless future for my children, growing professionally in my work, and maintaining friendships with people who look and live a lot like me. I'm convicted by these Bible stories, both by the apostles' boldness to leave the comforts of their culture and home despite the backlash they would face, and by the example of Jesus' servant leadership, his shedding of power and accumulation in favor of sacrifice. Madeleine L'Engle, the popular author of the children's fantasy novel A Wrinkle in Time and dozens other books, has a small book called My Bright Star, The Mystery of the Incarnation. And in it, L'Engle rejects the cultural claim that love is power, because as she looks at Christ's life, she sees precisely the opposite. Love is not power, she writes. Love is giving power away. Power in the sense of control. We want security. We want comfort. We want affluence. None of these give us freedom, but there is no such thing as certain security. We're thought of as an affluent country, though right now the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. I want enough money for shelter, a healthy diet, a comfortable mattress, enough clothes to keep me warm in the winter. Affluence has not helped us as a nation. It has softened us. When we are soft, we are less free. When we are less free, we are less human. She goes on, every question has to have an answer. There are rules to follow, and they can be followed without thinking because they become all right to dislike, distrust, and even hate other groups because your group is the chosen one. Keep your guns. It's your right. Hate your neighbor. He doesn't think the way you do. Tell your list of those you think are candidates for heaven and consign others to hell, and you will have power. And she says, it doesn't work. It never has worked. I don't always want freedom. I want security. I want comfort. I want nothing to go wrong, nobody I love to be hurt, to disappoint me. But that is not what Jesus offered. He offered life, and life more abundantly. And that means everything, the whole spectrum, laughter and tears, joy and disappointment. But above all, life lived fully and openly and appreciatively. That is how Jesus lived and how we are to live. Pedestrian, illiterate peasants carried very little earthly or cultural power, and yet they teach us the downward path of following Jesus. I'm intimidated by the countercultural courage of Peter and the apostles to move beyond their community and radically break the cultural norms in order to share the good news to communities who had, for all of times, been considered unclean and other. So, what are we to make of these stories for our lives and faith journeys today? What cultural undertow are we swept up in and afraid to swim out of as we pursue lives of faith? Many conservative American Christians contend that changing norms around sexuality, marriage, abortion, and public prayer are the great threats to Christianity. While many of us in the mainline church embrace progress with pride, I think we may too be missing the elephant in the room. What if L'Engle is right? Are we willing to examine how American and capitalist assumptions are real cultural roadblocks to following Jesus? Recently, my sweet small group, made up mostly by parishioners who have journeyed here to St. Mark's from evangelical backgrounds, read Rob Bell's new book, What is the Bible? And in the book, Bell adamantly and uncomfortably critiques our cultural assumptions. He says, "I was born in America, and I'm grateful for that. Freedom, rights, the chance to pursue your dreams, great. But America isn't just a nation, it's also a system. A system shaped by capitalism and democracy and corporations and convictions and a particular spirit that from the birth of America has been whispering in her ear, more. More land, more expansion, more wealth, more power, more influence, more customers, more square footage, more product for less money, more up and to the right. When in doubt, more, because more is better. But more is not always better. More is not always good. Sometimes more is bad, destructive, wrong, and sometimes it's downright evil." Bell points to a theme he sees emerging again and again in the Bible, and he says, "What will you do with your power and wealth and might and armies? What kind of world will you create with it? Will you use it to manipulate and overpower others to build your empire even bigger? Or will you use it to help the widow, the orphan, and the refugee among you?" I realize that it takes great courage and intentional commitment, like the apostles, to be willing to break from what our market world expects of us in order to be set free. In my work at Praxis, I've been thinking a lot about how faith-inspired business and nonprofit leaders can embody a different set of values than the dominant culture expects. To inspire this, we have crafted a rule of life for entrepreneurs who want their work and life to be redemptive. A rule of life is something that, for centuries, monastic traditions have shaped their lives around practices and rhythms for following Jesus together. It originated with Saint Benedict in 350 AD when he had come as a young man from rural Italy to Rome. Some of you may be familiar with this concept because last year our presiding bishop, Michael Curry, invited the Episcopal Church to follow a rule of life, which is titled The Way of Love, Practices for Jesus-Centered Life. In the same spirit, when my colleagues and I created this rule of life, designed specifically for entrepreneurs and leaders, we wanted to encourage rhythms and practices for those with much to commit themselves to shed their power and privilege for love's sake. These specific practices are focused on living open-handedly in the areas of time, power, community, money, imagination, and decision-making. For instance, in the area of power, we have committed to the active practice of gleaning, frequently sacrificing opportunities for our own advancement to intentionally create pathways for others. Those sacrificial acts reflect love as giving power away, more than as love as wielding it. And I wonder if these kinds of commitments, though they may feel as daunting as Peter's challenge to eat the beasts in the home of a Gentile, might be the dirt paths on which we may encounter Christ. This week, I met with a couple who live in Pomona in Southern California. When Tom and Bree were engaged, they made a life commitment in pursuit of walking steadfastly in Jesus' steps to intentionally live at the median household income of their community, which at the time was $35,000, and to give any excess of their income away. What they didn't know then was that in the years to come, Tom's job at a small company called Earthlink would become what it did. And though his work led to material wealth, they have continued to live by their bold and countercultural commitment to limit their personal accumulation and have given their resources with generosity to others. This has given them what they would say, a freedom and a love that is open-handed. Like Peter's abandonment of the old laws in order to share a meal with a Gentile, Tom and Bree's uncomfortable changes to their default lifestyle and the norms of our age have brought them into community with neighbors they otherwise wouldn't have been able to know. Their economic vulnerability brought them in closer communion with Christ and with others. They remind me that more is not always better. More is not always good. When Jesus ate with the disciples, he gave us a new commandment. He doesn't say, keep the religious laws, build an empire, accumulate wealth and followers, demand loyalty to a tribe, protect your brand, winners take all. No, he says to love one another. And he doesn't say that loving one another is to simply be kind, do no harm, campaign for progress, give charitably. No, he says, love as I have loved. And then he steps out of that small room and shows his disciples, shows us what love means. Amen.